Good morning, 10:45. My name's Mark. Let me apologise for my voice. It's character building. It's character building. That was the comment made to me as a young Year 7 kid as I sat beside a creek in one of the most remotest parts of the Hawkesbury River region. It was the final night of a six-week trek I'd been doing with my classmates, and I was completely exhausted. My classmate, who I was sharing a tent with, had tossed his backpack down a cliff at one point during the day as we were descending into this valley, and consequently he had lost two sections of the poles for our tent. It was raining, I was saturated, the food we had over the week was pretty much all gone, and we still had an entire day, the following day, to canoe out back to our main campsite. And I just did not want to sleep in the rain. And as I was complaining to our teacher that we were hopelessly out of our depth, he said to me, "It's character building. In the midst of all my temporary and tired trials, it did not occur to me that I could be someone better than just a complainer. In the midst of our daily trials, in all our times of suffering, we often fail to see how our experiences are developing our character. As Christians, we particularly know that suffering challenges our faith, our trust in God, often our focus is on remaining steadfast during suffering, steadfast in faith. Yet part of any testing is the development of our character. Listen to what Paul says from the beginning of Romans chapter 5. Paul writes, "We rejoice in our afflictions because we know that affliction produces endurance. Endurance produces proven character, and proven character produces hope." Did you hear that process during suffering? We rejoice in our afflictions because we know that affliction produces endurance. Endurance produces proven character, and proven character produces hope. That suffering eventually leads to hope in glory, hope in redemption. Yet we must persevere, be steadfast in our faith, and have our character proven as well. What is the Christian character that God is developing in us as we go through times of trial? Well, today as we consider God's plan, we'll be considering God's plans and purposes for his people, Jacob and his sons. And the focus of the passages that we're looking at are Jacob's son, Joseph. Do you remember Jacob from Genesis 37? I think he's a bit of he's the spoiled brat of the family. He dobbed on his brothers. He shared dreams with them, which left them concluding that he was expecting to rule over them. And from my experience of parenting, any kid that starts claiming he is better than the other is just looking to get his face smashed. Well, that's what happens in our household. Well, it was the same in Jacob's household. His brothers ended up selling him into slavery in Egypt. Now, I don't think any of my children would try and pull that off, but that is an extreme. It's a harsh and unjust punishment. And really, the brothers are acting without any concern for God and his plans. So we pick up the story of Joseph at the start of chapter 39. I trust you've got that in front of you, chapter 39, where we're reminded in verse 1 of how Joseph was enslaved in Palestine and then sold to Potiphar in Egypt. Joseph knows suffering. He knows what it is to be rejected and abused, forced to live far away from his home. However, he becomes for us a great example of the process of having his character shaped and developed through affliction. And we see here that Joseph's character is really shaped because God is with him. That comes out several times in chapter 39. So you look at there in verse 2, Yahweh was with Joseph and he became a successful man, serving in the household of his Egyptian master. And then down in verse 21 to 23, but Yahweh was with Joseph and extended kindness to him. He granted him favor with the prison warden. The warden put all the prisoners who were in the prison under Joseph's authority, and he was responsible for everything that was done there. The warden did not bother with anything under Joseph's authority because Yahweh was with him, and Yahweh made everything that he did successful. Now, it's no strange coincidence that Joseph finds success in everything he does. The passage is clear. God was with him. Joseph may have been a very competent manager of households and prisons before he got to Egypt. We just don't know that. The text doesn't tell us. However, these verses certainly highlight that because of God's involvement, his abilities, his competencies are taken to the next level. He finds favor and he finds great success. But Joseph is not merely growing in his competencies for managing households. In the middle section of this chapter, we see how God has also been shaping Joseph's character while Potiphar's wife attempts to seduce him. I really remember this passage as a young kid. We were taught this in Sunday school, and I was a bit shocked that adults could act this way. So we read in the middle of verse 6, now Joseph was well built and handsome. Actually, that's probably the verse that stood out to me as a young kid, modelling myself after Joseph. Now Joseph was well built and handsome. After some time, his master's wife looked longingly at Joseph and said, sleep with me. But he refused. Look, he said to his master's wife, with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in his house, and he has put all that he owns under my authority. No one in this house is greater than I am. He has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. So how could I do this immense evil, and how could I sin against God? Although she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her. With God's blessing, Joseph has become responsible for everything in Potiphar's household. Consequently, to sleep with her, to do this immense evil against Potiphar, would be a rejection of God and all his blessings. It would be a sin against God. The character that rejects evil and sin is a godlike character. Despite the unjust suffering that Joseph is facing by being in Egypt, he chooses to honour the God who was with him, honour God who is helping him endure through this time of suffering. Now, the constant challenge we face with temptation is to give into it. Just as I sat cold and miserable beside that creek bank, I just wanted a yacht to come by and pick me up and take me back home. I just wanted to avoid the situation that I was in. Potiphar's wife, day after day, attempted to wear down Joseph. No doubt you know that daily challenge as well as I do. But remember, the godlike character flees sin and evil. It does not give in to temptation. And fleeing sin is essentially, or literally, what Joseph does. And it even lands him in prison. Friends, we have a greater promise of the presence of God in our lives than Joseph ever had. In Matthew 28, Jesus says, because all authority has been given to him, he says in the last verse, remember, I am with you always to the end of the age. We too have the promise of God's presence with us. I am with you always to the end of the age. Now, Jesus' presence may well grant you success in different areas of your life, make you competent in various Christian ministries. And in that context of Matthew 28, the focus is on making disciples of the nations. Maybe you will be great and successful in that. But these verses really hint at the type of character that God's shaping within us too. Because Christ has all authority and he wants us to make disciples, he says to teach and train everyone to live in obedience to everything that he has commanded. The type of character that God is shaping within us is a Christ-like character, a character that listens to Jesus' teaching, observes it, and puts it into action. Like Joseph, a Christ-like character flees evil, knowing that Christ has died for sin. The holy God-like character that Joseph displays here is the holy Christ-like character that God is developing in us by his Spirit as we endure through suffering. Let's continue into chapter 40. And we observe how God is really developing endurance within Joseph. And there's only two verses I want to highlight from this chapter. The narrative itself is pretty straightforward. It gets repeated a little bit in chapter 41. Well, Pharaoh's cupbearer and his baker commit a crime, verse 1, and find themselves in prison with Joseph. Now, maybe you can imagine these guys as the prime minister's PA and his communications officer. Two very important roles in Pharaoh's administration. In prison, the cupbearer and baker both have this similar dream, and it leaves them both very disturbed. So verses 5 to 7, they don't know what the dreams mean. And so Joseph pipes up at the end of verse 8. Don't interpretations belong to God? Tell me your dreams. So where do the cupbearer and baker find meaning for their dreams? Well, it's God who gives them meaning. It's God who interprets them. And we find out that God is actually speaking through the dreams. He's speaking directly. He has a word of judgment for both the cupbearer and the baker. And it's not just merely explaining what will happen in the future. God is telling them through these dreams, through his word, which is spoken by Joseph, who's really acting like a prophet at this point. God's explaining what he will be doing. It is God who is judging the cupbearer and the baker for their crime. And Pharaoh is a pawn. He's a co-worker in God's act of judgment. For we see in verses 9 to 19, God says to them both that in 3 days they'll be brought before Pharaoh. And Pharaoh will lift up their heads. I think the image there is like you see a guilty child, they come to mum and dad, and you lift up their head to make eye contact. So Pharaoh will lift up their heads. I've done that a few times as a parent. Look at me. Lift up the chin. The cupbearer's head will be lifted and he will gaze at a smile. He will be restored. Well, the baker's head will be lifted up and taken off. He'll be sent to the gallows. God gives meaning to these dreams. He interprets the dreams. He speaks through the dreams. And in verses 20 to 22, this judgment comes about as God has declared. Just keep that in the back of your mind because it will come up again in chapter 41. The other verses worth noting are really at the end of verses 14 and 15 of chapter 40. When Joseph speaks to the cupbearer and saying that he will be restored, he says from verse 14, "But when all goes well for you, remember that I was with you. Please show kindness to me by mentioning me to Pharaoh and get me out of this prison. For I was kidnapped from the land of the Hebrews, and even here I have done nothing that they should put me in the dungeon." So again, notice that Joseph knows suffering. He can see his situation is unjust. However, he has to learn that salvation will not be at the hands of either Pharaoh or the cupbearer. For we read in verse 23, "Yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph. He forgot him." The preliminary lesson that you need to learn while you're going through suffering is don't rely on the one who cannot save you, the one who forgets you. Well, this brings us nicely to the beginning of chapter 41. I suppose here we can take a breath and realise we've really been on a roller coaster ride. I find reading this story that Joseph finds this great success in Potiphar's household, but then, you know, his wife brings him down, he lands in prison. He's successful in prison, but now he's forgotten by the cupbearer. It's a bit of a roller coaster ride. Chapter 41 is a bit like a tight corkscrew that sends you on another round of these ups and downs. But again, it's in Hollywood style. It's brought presently home in the style of a great Andrew Lloyd Webber musical. So hang out for that at the end. Well, chapter 41 begins 2 years later when the king of Egypt, two very unsettling dreams, very similar to 40. This is chapter 40. This is what we've got to realise. This bit of a repetition happening here on purpose. So have a look at verse 1. Pharaoh was standing beside the Nile when seven healthy-looking, well-fed cows came up from the Nile and began to graze amongst the reeds. After them, seven other cows, sickly and thin, came up from the Nile and stood beside those cows along the bank of the Nile. Then the sickly, thin cows ate the healthy, well-fed cows. Then Pharaoh woke up. He fell asleep and dreamed a second time. Seven heads of grain, plump and good, came up on one stalk. After them, seven heads of grain, thin and scorched by the east wind, sprouted up. The thin heads of grain swallowed up the seven plump, full ones. Then Pharaoh woke up, and it was only a dream. Well, these dreams really disturbed Pharaoh, and it turns out that all Pharaoh's officials, his wise men, his magicians, cannot interpret or give meaning to these dreams. Of course, we know there is someone who can give meaning to dreams, and the cupbearer finally gets his act together and he remembers Joseph, who was with him in prison. And Joseph is summoned to the palace, where Pharaoh says to him in verse 15, "I have had a dream and no one can interpret it, but I have heard it said about you that you can hear a dream and interpret it." Nonsense. Rubbish. Do you know those short one-word answers in the middle of a discussion that sort of totally rebut everything you say? One of my children likes to grunt out, "Huh," whenever she disagrees with what Rochelle and I are saying. Joseph very boldly cuts off Pharaoh at this point with one of those simple one-word rebuttals. "I've heard about you that you can hear a dream and interpret it." "Nonsense," Joseph answered Pharaoh. "It is God who will give Pharaoh a favourable answer." That's a very bold way to respond. Of course, we remember that Joseph's question to his two inmates back in chapter 40, don't interpretations belong to God? That's in the back of our minds already. So Joseph can go on to interpret and give meaning to Pharaoh's dreams. So what are the dreams about? Joseph tells Pharaoh straight in verse 25. And Joseph said to Pharaoh, "Pharaoh's dreams mean the same thing. God has revealed to Pharaoh what he is about to do." Again, God gives meaning to the dreams because he is speaking to Pharaoh through the dreams. And so it is the sovereign creator who tells Pharaoh that he is going to bring a time of great blessing on the land of Egypt, 7 years of bountiful harvest. However, he will then bring 7 years of extreme famine on the land. And Joseph is extremely emphatic. This is what God is planning to do. This is what will happen. God will do it. And interestingly, from verse 33, Joseph starts advising Pharaoh on how to live wisely over this 14-year period. He says in verse 33, "So now let Pharaoh look for a discerning and wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh do this. Let him appoint overseers over the land and take a fifth of the harvest of the land of Egypt during the 7 years of abundance." And it goes on to the end of verse 36. Again, we might say Joseph is extremely assertive with his advice here, telling Pharaoh how to respond. But we haven't forgotten chapter 39. God is with him. So we're really not surprised that once again God gives Joseph great success, gives him favor in Pharaoh's household. So Joseph is elevated to the king's right-hand man. Have a look at verse 44. "Pharaoh said to him, 'I am Pharaoh, and no one